Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Chagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagalani-Alba. We are super excited. I don't want to take even an extra second away from time with our guest. So will you please introduce yourself and tell us who you are and what you do?
Hi. Officially, I'm called Dr. Khalil Abraham Vernon Betts Heinemann, but you can call me Avi, A-V-I. Who am I? Well, anthropologically, that's quite a complex question. Because it's the whole discipline about it. Not about me specifically, asking about human beings. But broadly speaking, I'm a social anthropologist. I've just moved to Helsinki to do a project on mosquitoes, the things that hitchhike on mosquitoes, and what we can do about that. How to live with mosquito-borne disease. And they're not the only things that are hitchhiking on mosquitoes. There's also a whole bioeconomy of people making some good dollar off that. So that's kind of what I'm here to do in Helsinki.
Welcome, Avi. I mean, it's such a pleasure to have you on here, getting somebody who's fresh into the University of Helsinki. So I guess for our listeners and for ourselves, how did you get into this in social anthropology and mosquitoes? Would you want to walk us through a little bit of your journey getting here?
So basically, I mean, how far do we want to go back to, like, my birth or to the preceding step? Because there is a linear narrative that follows through. But broadly speaking, I always was fascinated by animals. I don't have a broad love or hate of them. They're just other kind of folks, some of which are very annoying and some of which are less annoying, milling about out there. And when I was growing up, I volunteered in a vet. I volunteered in conservation projects. When I was volunteering in the vet, I couldn't get over the fact that we had to keep putting down lots of ill stray dogs, but no one ever seemed to have the time, I'm not saying people didn't think about it, have the time to address why there were so many stray dogs and cats to start with. Instead, it was just a process of trying to control the population through neutering and spaying them and then re-releasing them because there wasn't enough resources to have a big enough pound. In any case, I went on to do some genetics, I wanted to do this and that. I didn't do veterinary medicine in the end. And then when I was doing anthropology, I just kept knocking back on the door of people's relationship with animals. Then in my PhD, I ended up studying hunting in northern Cyprus, which does involve dogs and is part of the ecosystem of why there are lots of stray dogs. In any case, on the side of that project on hunting, I collaborated with some local geneticists, the Hunting Federation, some conservationists, to do a study on a culling and pest control technique that they use. So people might not know, but within Europe at least, crows and magpies are often culled as an agricultural and wildlife pest based on a number of myths and ideas about the harm that they do. I even saw it in Paw Patrol the other day when I was with my nephew, how evil the crows were, and they were eating all the corn, and Paw Patrol had to come to the rescue. So if you don't know about it, go watch your Paw Patrol. In any case, what was interesting amongst my participants was that they would continually say, no matter how many we try to cull, there's always more every year. So I tried to take that statement seriously rather than dismissing it, and essentially developed a hypothesis based on a couple of other studies in other places that the social world of crows and the implementation of the cull itself meant that the particular plan, the kind of idea, if I reduce this percentage of a population, then overall the population will reduce over time, or at least maintain stability. Now, this idea doesn't take into consideration the fact that there is a lot of social complexity among humans and non-humans. So we took that into consideration and essentially came to the conclusion that the culling itself was actually promoting more reproduction amongst corvids, and this was probably exacerbating the amount of corvids that you would see. There's also some other interesting speculations about the impact it would have on corvid culture, but we'll put that to the side for a minute. In any case, out of that, I then ended up in a job teaching public health. Don't ask me exactly how that happened, but essentially pest control and disease management exist within a shared set of logics. So that's partly how I ended up doing that. And whilst I was doing that job, I was teaching a lot of master's students who were health practitioners and who'd come into the world of public health, and they were fed up of firefighting. They were doing this master's so that they could try and understand some of the complexity of what was going on. And I was doing this for 3 years, felt like quite a long time. And then in January this year, I thought, okay, this is probably my last opportunity to like cash in on my academic capital gained through having a PhD. Because until this point, I was doing teaching, but most of my activities beyond that were activism and campaigning stuff. And so I basically just had a long meditation session and tried to work out what were the different threads in my life, and especially my academic life, that made sense as one project. And I wrote that project, and that's what I applied for to a number of places, and it so happened to fit very well into a postdoc that was being offered at Helsinki. So in summary, Finland was up for paying me to do this project, so I came to Finland. It's not the, as we know, all histories are one narrative, so there's a couple of other threads in there, but that's the academic thread.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for telling us a little bit about your trajectory and how you got to Finland. Mosquitoes, though, wow. Yeah, I've definitely had my fair share of tangles with mosquitoes in the Finnish countryside. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about this project. Are you going to be looking at mosquitoes here, mosquitoes in the wider world? Could you generally tell us a bit about what this project looks like in practice?
So first, I should say, I don't really know anything about mosquitoes. I'm not a mosquito expert. There's plenty of people who probably know more about proboscises and legs and different weird parts of a mosquito's body. Although I did read the other day that no one is entirely sure how mosquitoes attract each other during mating. So I might have to look into that further. In any case, my expertise is basically in people who have expertise in mosquitoes, people who have expertise in things that mosquitoes carry, and in the context in which people try to control pests, or what I broadly call, there are animals in the world that people think are good, and there are animals that people think are bad. So there are unwanted animals and there are wanted animals. And I'm interested in the unwanted animals. Why are they unwanted is usually quite a quick answer, but how people then deal with them being unwanted, how they get rid of them, whether that's effective, which it usually isn't. And so if it isn't, then what else can you do instead? Because, you know, I don't have any particular love for mosquitoes. So just to tie up on that point and answer your question, the project essentially came out of the idea that there's a broad discourse of war when it comes to disease and when it comes to pests. So you will have heard it in COVID. You will hear it when dealing with rats. You will hear it when dealing with diseases. You hear it with dealing with mosquito control. Is you're going to fight it. You're going to fight something, and you're going to try and defeat it. And if you can't defeat it, you're at least going to fight it and you're going to control it. And so what is this narrative about? Well, it's very simple in the sense that it emerges directly from what is known today as Darwinist or neo-Darwinist evolutionary theory, or what I call orthodox biology. And in orthodox biology or orthodox evolutionary theory, everything is in a struggle to compete with something else and basically win an endless competition and grow endlessly forever. I mean, this was just directly taken from neoclassical economics. Most adjacent biosciences don't believe in this interpretation of evolutionary theory. You have whole subfields which underpin even things like the creation of the vaccine that would not go along with this essentially quite hokey story, but it persists. And it's called the modern evolutionary synthesis is the one version of what it's called. And people have tried to greatly extend it, which has its own problem. But in any case, I'm going off topic. So coming back to the mosquitoes. So the question is, for me, is to look where new technologies for controlling mosquitoes are coming into place, right? And the reason I came to look at mosquito control technologies is that during my research in Northern Cyprus, I dug up some documents in the National Archives there. And one of them was a document about a dude called Mehmet Aziz. And this dude was a public health official during the British colonial period. He met a guy called Ronald Ross. Ronald Ross is the person that is, according to the normal narrative, given credit for discovering the parasite that transmits malaria. And so he trained and apprenticed under Ronald Ross. And this Turkish Cypriot doctor went on to plan a program in Cyprus, covering the whole of Cyprus, using mapping technologies and DDT, or let's just say chemical solutions. And he managed to make Cyprus the first country in the world to eradicate malaria. I'm yet to work out how much this influenced the later WHO program in the 50s, because his program preceded it in the 40s, but I'll look into that. So that's what I'll be doing the past week, is basically reading through some of these documents and anthropologically contextualizing the first successful innovation at eradicating malaria, which doesn't make it into most of the course materials when you go into public health. They always start with the WHO program. It's like, well, actually, there was some Cypriot dude who was quite successful. Now, today, we might look down upon those programs because they used DDT, but I still think we need to think about what was innovative in those moments in comparison to the long-term harms and the kind of state-forming and territorialization that came along with them. So that's the step I'm at now. And then the idea over the whole project is to look at other kind of new mosquito control technologies, which happen to usually be based around controlling reproduction, for want of a better, easily accessible idea. One of them is essentially a genetic condom, and the other one is an STD, which stops them from reproducing so well. So those are the two main ones. They're not called that in the literature, but that's what they are. And the third one I'll be looking at is what you call dwelling modifications. So these might be modifications inside housing or how something is spatially set up. And there was a brilliant study a couple years ago, which retrospectively looked at the transmission of mosquito-borne disease in Costa Rica in relation to housing quality and general urbanization, and demonstrated, supporting evidence that already existed, that the only long-term solution for reducing the transmission of mosquito-borne diseases is essentially quality living standards. That's the claim. That's the situation. That's what I understand from the literature. I'm going into this open-minded. The idea is to work with local, already organized people in the different locations that these new technologies are being implemented, to see how they feel about these technologies being introduced, right? So I know this is an extractivist podcast, and some years ago I came across something called assess.technology. That's their URL, part of something called the ECR group. They usually do with mining. That was the original start. And what they do is, when a new mining project is introduced, they essentially work with the local community where a mine is to facilitate them to come to their own conclusion, right? Rather than paying some unknown person to come and do kind of half-assed sustainability assessment and some bullshit consultation, and then use that to justify something. Instead, this is a grassroots assessment and evaluation of whether or not they're up for that technology. Also, because the idea is there, it's not entirely up to someone in another country to go, well, we don't want mining to happen here because that's going to be environmentally destructive. You need to also include the people that are living in that local context. Anyway, so they've had some success. And I was inspired by that and some other experiences of participatory methods to think, well, what would it be like to ask people in different places about what they already do to manage mosquito-borne disease? What do they see as the problems? Including doing some of my own research on the side and triangulation of what might be happening. And then essentially do a participatory evaluation of that technology with them. And then the idea would be to put them into conversation with each other, because that's where something special starts to happen. When you know, the anthropological phrase, making something familiar strange and something strange familiar, right? Once you are out of your context of thinking about mosquitoes and mosquito-borne disease, and you suddenly see mosquitoes and mosquito-borne disease in a different place, it's not the same, but there's an analogous situation where you might start to understand and learn more about your own situation. And there might be the idea of best practices that could be shared. But in any case, that's the ambition. Basically, I want to join the conversation around addressing mosquito-borne disease, and I want to bring an anthropological background to that, provide some depth of context to those conversations. And if it so happens that a kind of more democratic, decentralized, ultra-globalized response to mosquito born disease is to occur that isn't funded by Bill Gates and other billionaires, then that would be fantastic. That's the ambition.
Wow, that is absolutely fascinating. And I mean, there's so many things that you've brought up that are just sparking so many different thoughts in my head. And I apologize, because I kind of want to ask you two questions sort of in a row. Maybe I'll ask my first one and then my second one, because like when you were talking about your PhD work, I absolutely love corvids. You know, always have found them fascinating, and then learning about how incredibly intelligent they are, and to hear of them as like pests. I mean, of course, you know, it's like where I grew up and everything, you know, to your farmers, and they talk about it, but I never heard of like such culls. So I mean, it's just a very sad thing for me. But something you had mentioned, which I'd love to just ask about out of my own curiosity before getting back to mosquitoes. You said that there was some speculation on impacts of the culling on corvid culture. So I'm just kind of curious to hear that speculation.
Okay, so thanks for the question, Chris. So I was working with an ornithologist and two geneticists and doing lots of reading. And the essentially, to me, academia is a dialogue over time. You never fully know anything. The question is, what evidence is there to generate an interesting point? And in the paper that we wrote, it was based on someone else's expertise in how corvids go about life. And what I picked up from reading the small print in some books and text was the kind of premise of people culling is, and a lot of kind of pop biology would be that crows are just running around trying to shag each other to death and have as many babies as possible and reproduce as much as possible. Okay, if that is the case, then a kind of blunt culling of them makes sense, because it's just a quants game, right? But what this, I don't remember the particular authors that cited in that paper. What they pointed out was that from their transects and from their studies of corvids in the so-called wild, is that they tend to group up into different social groups, and depending on whatever region or country, and it can be very different. Some of them are same-sex groups, some of them are not. And reproduction is just one small part of their life, which tends to center around one female and a whole bunch of males. So already there's a dependency. For example, I've speculated to the hunters, if your hunting season takes place during nesting period, you're probably just going to be knocking off a few extra males. You're not really going to be impacting the reproduction overall of a generation of crows. It so happens that the cull was happening during the nesting period. And that was the main point in that paper. Secondary point was, people might not appreciate me interpreting it like this, but essentially crows are just as queer as human beings are. So what they observe is that there's like bunches of male crows and bunches of female crows all having playtime with each other, not really interested in reproducing at all, or doesn't necessarily need to be queer in that sense. The point is that they're just not normative sex machines rolling around trying to make babies. They're doing lots of other stuff and getting on with life, and in some sense self-organizing their own generational reproduction. Now, what happens if you just think about, if you roll into a population and you start like blasting the shit out of it, excuse my language, then you essentially upset any self-organization that is occurring within that social group. And what then happens, or the pressure that is applied, as to why this happens is not entirely clear to me, but there's different ways to speculate this. One is that if you're kind of ruining the culture of crows and creating a kind of precarious situation where there isn't any self-organization between generations, then maybe it's just like a bunch of teenagers. And so that's what they just get up to, is lots of shagging. Another way to interpret it is that there might be something more instinctual about needing to reproduce more generations and kind of bring more people into reproduction, bring more crows into reproduction. It's not entirely clear why that is to me, but I don't know if that's helping answer your question. I would mention quickly, I was inspired by this thought by a study that took place in Tasmania, I think it was, where they were trying to reduce the size of stray cat population because they were eating lots of other things. And the person noticed that the method of culling was targeting what they called alpha male cats, just so happened to be catching more of them. And in the social structure of those cats on that island, they were essentially suppressing reproduction in every direction between every individual. And so within their social structure, once they removed the alpha male, there was a lot more sex happening. And then there was a lot more reproduction, so they suddenly had more cats. And then I was like, this is not the same in crows, but I wonder if some kind of logic of intervening without understanding what your intervention is doing, because you're not taking into consideration the life world of the crows, might be leading to unintended consequences. And so to bring that around to mosquitoes, it's not so directly translatable, but some of these genetic technologies create some relatable ideas for unintended consequences, right? That I'm really interested in those things. And I don't think that they should be called unexpected consequences, what I used to call them. They're unintended consequences, because if you're a bit more patient, you can generally improve the situation. You can expect something.
Wow, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I mean, as I said, I always find corvids really fascinating, and especially like, you know, just seeing different things about, yeah, how they have that culture. And, you know, it's as well too, I'd imagine, and something that kind of popped in my head when you were talking about the culls and the population not going down, is like, well, you know, even if you're looking at from the neoclassical point of view of competition for food, you're just reducing the competition for food. So do you really expect it to do something? But that's an aside. A comment that I wanted to make too, I find it so interesting and sad, because like biology is not my thing. Like I liked it in high school, but haven't really had anything to do with it since. So I find this idea of the kind of orthodox biology slash evolutionary theory quite sad and interesting to see that like neoclassical economics has infected that also like a disease. But something I'd like to ask about with this project, and this is kind of a general question, but have you nailed down which context you'd like to look at? I mean, of course, you know, I do my work in Zambia, so like mosquito-borne diseases are a thing there. I mean, I have some people very close to me who have lost family members to malaria. So yeah, I'm curious, what are these contexts that these sort of new technologies are being implemented in?
So I just first say that, as you guys probably know, anthropology is quite iterative. So I do expect that things may change. But the solid plan that me and my supervisor, Sarah Green, put together, or I put together, and then we discussed it, is first I want to understand Cyprus. That's the primary context. The reason I want to do that is because as a country that eradicated malaria first, this is the story, right? I'm going to investigate this more. There are now signs that it's not going to be long before malaria returns in some form. Okay, so there are a number of mosquito-borne diseases that have already arrived more lately, like West Nile virus. And the mosquitoes that carry malaria have returned. But they've also returned to places like Southeast England. And I believe recently somewhere in Scandinavia as well. So that's a precursor, right, to mosquito-borne diseases, having the right mosquitoes, because there's lots of different types of mosquitoes and only certain mosquitoes. So the one that's the big bad often is the Anopheles. And there are a number of different types of Anopheles. Anyway, so I want to look at Cyprus at this point where it's considering what are we going to do next to try and like either mitigate that from happening or respond to a crisis that might be on the horizon. And right now there's lots of innovation within chemistry happening in Cyprus to try and think about how to deal with that. You also got to think that there's multiple polities or political authorities in that context, including this British sovereign bases. There's the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, there's the Republic of Cyprus, there's the UN Green Line. Then you've got lots of privately owned public spaces, and you've got huge casino complexes, you've got lots of military bases. There is a Venn diagram of sovereignties overlapping each other all over the place, in which there is a sliver that, let's say, so-called native Cypriots might actually exist, and in which there is a so-called public space and an idea of an imagination in which there is a public to have a health with which to protect. It doesn't actually look like that. As I was saying, there's all of this Venn diagram of different people with different public health policies, so on and so forth, and how much they coordinate and work. So that's what I would be looking at. And one of the main ideas is also to look at universities there. So broadly speaking, one of the largest industries, at least in the northern part of the island, are universities. So as the north can't formally export anything except to the Turkish state, one way they got around that was by importing people who pay money. And historically, one of the determinants for universities, in my opinion, is that Turkish Cyprus used to have the highest literacy in Europe, leading to the end of the 20th century. You've got a lot of literate people. There's a number of other factors at play here. The kind of location of it, both in Europe and not in Europe, creates a possibility for people in African continent and also within the Middle East, either escaping war or limited universities in our home countries coming there. Anyway, the whole point of that context is there is a kind of bubbling under the surface narrative that it's these people migrating to Cyprus that are bringing all these diseases. There's no evidence for this. And if anything, I would say it's probably the quality of housing that they're putting. But that's that to investigate. And then to answer your question, as it currently stands, I'm looking for collaborators. I found some collaborators in Marshall Islands. The reason Marshall Islands is that there is an organization called OxyTech, who will be introducing a gene drive program in response to dengue outbreak in Marshall Islands, which is a horrible situation, and that should be happening sometime this year. And then the other, like somewhere in the Indonesian context at the moment, because of my context, it might be somewhere around Timor Leste, and that's in relation to Wolbachia. There's a bacteria that they infect mosquitoes. And then the other context at the moment is just broadly called Costa Rica, because I want to understand that kind of housing approach, even if it wasn't intentional. And those places have been picked because they are intercontinental locations. That's what I'm calling them. They are not where the hotspots of mosquito-borne disease necessarily exist, but one of the drivers of mosquito-borne disease is that as climates and kind of ecologies are shifting, so mosquitoes shift with them, also trade routes, so on and so forth. So you have these interesting spaces in between what you might imagine as continental centers, and what happens in these spaces, Cyprus being historically one of those, and those other locations also having some kind of intercontinental relationship. So those are the contexts. I don't intend to become an expert anthropologist in those other locations, but I intend to collaborate with researchers in those contexts and essentially coordinate with them to produce papers and films that can then be communicated between each other locations.
You have blown my mind open. There are things, for lack of a better word, related to this question of pest management, disease control, mosquitoes, birds. Like, you have brought in truly so many different threads that I don't even think I'd thought to think about in these larger questions of kind of how things work. And I think that the point that you made about unintended consequences is so interesting. And it really, I agree. Like, it feels like when we start to mess with things, because the webs are so complex, you know, who knows what's actually going to come out of it. And I also really appreciate the point that you brought up about the cultures of the animals, that they have their own cultures and life worlds happening at the same time that we have, you know, our thoughts about what's happening. I was wondering if you would be open to telling us a little bit about, like, how you actually approach your projects. What kind of methods do you use? Are you actually on the ground? Like, what are you doing?
Great question. So I'm kind of a little bit of a rough and ready speaker, right? So I'm not particularly great at articulating the particularities and different wording of different methodologies. So when I say what I'm going to say next, I'm not denigrating people who are highly skilled at being able to do that. It's just not my strength. But broadly speaking, there's a great quote from an anthropologist, Keith Hart, about what do anthropologists actually do. And he's like, well, they go to a place and they talk to people, they watch TV, they listen to the radio, they play the games that people are playing there, they eat the food, and they just get along, or don't get along with people, but do what they're doing. This idea that the anthropology is in the interview or only in the specific notes of a specific practice is well, some people can believe that if they want. It's more of that kind of an attention to the whole process, and I think that would definitely resonate with people who are doing a PhD in anthropology, right? Because you have the time to do that. In terms of this project and how that will actually look, I'm going to say that there's kind of three levels to it. The first level is establishing good rapport and trusting relations with people in those locations who are already self-organizing or experts in the local context, right? I'm not going there to tell anyone something yet. There is a part where we'll get to the second point. I'm going there to learn from them, to understand their context, from multiple different people. So just going and listening, really, that's this first step. Listening, learning based on trusting relationships. And then second step is supporting non-academics to verbalize their stories in a linear form. So I don't know whoever's been listening has been to a therapist or not, but in a therapist, you kind of have given the moment to think about your life and kind of tell it out as a story and work it out and bring some coherency to it, right? You're basically giving voice to yourself. So in a social, in a kind of anthropological context, you are also facilitating making a moment for people who may or may not have a platform to put that voice, but may have not even taken the moment or time or had someone to facilitate bringing out a kind of story about what is happening. So that's the second part to me, which is listening, then helping craft some story. So that would be participatory. The reason I mentioned film is I feel like that is one of the mediums of today. And when I say film, audio is the kind of base of that, just to give a nod to podcasting. So there will be text and papers that go along with that, because text is very important, at least for me, in terms of like processing and analyzing and telling something in a specific way and getting to the heart of theory. In terms of communications, basically making short films with people. That's the second part of the method. And third part of the method is you don't really know what's going to happen once everyone starts talking to each other and once you make those films. So the third part of the method is open box to see what might happen. Because alongside this, I would say there's a number of things about citizen assemblies, participatory approaches, that, you know, I don't really want to go into the detail of them, and I might not do it myself and collaborate with other people. But for me, the joy part, my own personal joy, will come from using the philosophical basis that I enjoy, such as Roy Bhaskar's work. And also Sarah Green's concepts of cross locations, to really try and delve into what is going on at a kind of deeper level, to me at least, maybe it's not deeper to anyone else, kind of metaphysical level, what is happening there. So that's what I'll be enjoying for myself, and anyone who wants to have a chat with me about that will enjoy that. But alongside that, yes, there's a commitment to seeing if this conversation can support and help drive people in whatever direction they want to do to try and realize a future with mosquitoes that's not based on a false war. I know maybe that doesn't answer what the methods are, but that's how I see them. I guess it's a kind of, to wrap up, I say there's an ethic. I can't tell who shares it and who doesn't. I broadly expect social anthropologists to share it more because of similar training. But once you've unpacked, you know, you've done a bit of STS, you've done a bit of history, you've done a bit of field work, you've done participant observation, you start to grasp that things should not be taken at face value or taken for granted. Those are also important, but contextualizing that, trying to dig underneath that, trying to triangulate that, doesn't mean you can't say anything, doesn't mean you can't generalize, doesn't mean you can't speak to a truth. It's just never the totalizing way of doing it. That's messy. And so I will say a final point. Now, when I said at the beginning, an example of this was when I said at the beginning, why am I in Finland? I told a particular thread of a story, right, around designing a project and then getting funded. So that was a retrospective cleaning up what anthropologist Pickering would call that there's a mangle of practice, right? And then in scientific writing, go back and you polish it so it looked like there was a linear kind of thing that led from hypothesis to prove or not prove and so on and so forth. And so I just did the same with that. You know, in reality, there were many other histories, more subaltern things that I might not mention, things that I could mention, friendships, so on and so forth. And that's okay.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is a single podcast episode. You know, as much as we would love to be able to get into all the different angles and things, you know, there is a limited amount of time. But man, you getting into so many fascinating aspects, and I mean, you know, something I'm glad you brought up again. This like this false war, because when you were saying that earlier, like that was something that also really resonated with me, and the sort of framing, like, you know, the neoclassical economics, the false war, this sort of power projection and state power. And I'd never really thought about it too much, but it is quite fascinating. And I'm sure that must really shape the thoughts of people who are living in these contexts and how they approach these things. But, you know, something I want to ask about, because another point that you brought up that I really love in what you're doing is this filmmaking. You know, in academia, it's been really nice to see this bigger trend of more popular science communication and getting messages out in ways that are digestible for quote unquote normal people. You know, with our doing a podcast, one of the things that I love, and of course, we get to have fascinating conversations like this. And I mean, not to get into it too much, because I know we'll have a whole other thing in the future, spoiler alert. But how did it come to you to have film as part of this?
That's a good question. There are a number of answers, but broadly speaking, my experience with a project called From the Cubby that I've been working on led me to the conclusion that a film is not a dumber version of something else like a text. It's a parallel. It both communicates just as a paper communicates, but it also does a certain kind of analysis. So the colleagues that I work with on the film The Cubby, Joe and Nick, sort of the project about lived experience of homelessness and the spread of tuberculosis in Southeast England, call it garbology. So the idea, I mean, it kind of comes from assemblage from that French dude. And the idea is just like when you're writing composite characters in an ethnography, and you're piecing together different pieces and comparing, contrasting them. Same with film. You can do reconstructions. You can put together bits of interview with bits of stock footage. And so you are trying to explore a context. To me, what I found about film is it's kind of got more space as a viewer to sit comfortably within. It's kind of more, the bandwidth is a bit wider for whoever's viewing it. Whereas with a text, it's quite a clarified and narrow bandwidth that you are being led down, which requires a kind of attention span that is very focused in comparison to watching a film, where you can tune in and tune out slightly sometimes, and you're still within that bandwidth. So there's a kind of there's an e a more of an ease with film. This is at least my way of relating. There's more of an ease with it, and I don't see why life should be this highly stressed, uneasy situation. I mean, I'm not a Puritan, so you know, that. Let's watch more films, and they can do just as good academic work. I don't know if something to do with the attention economy is at play, but if it is at play, well, so be it. Until you fixed it, you're going to have to communicate within that context.
I think it's so important because, you know, you can do the best science in the world, but if nobody will interact with it, then what is it? What does it actually matter for? So I really appreciate that you're exploring methods to bring things to people in a way that they are actually open to receiving.
Right. And then the part of that is also, if you're working across multiple languages, then a film, you know, has all like bodies and faces and all of those things and voice notes. I mean, I just noticed that I just got introduced to Finnish cinema. I think I forget the name of the director, but his new film, Fallen Leaves. And my friend said, let's watch this Finnish classic film. I was like, has it got subtitles? She was like, no. I was like, oh, this is going to be hard. I'm not going to understand what's going on. okay, there's barely any words said in it, but the films are told so well that it doesn't matter that I didn't understand any of the language taking place. So that also, you know, the kind of cross-language situation is very helpful. It's also just fun doing editing, but anyway.
Absolutely. And it's funny with this too, because it's the classic thing in filmmaking of show, don't tell. And if you're really doing a good job with it, be it documentary or, you know, more artistic, if you're showing, not telling, then people can get it regardless of the language. And I mean, as well, I love with this idea of film that it lets people speak with their own voices. I mean, of course, everything's edited and stuff like that. But like, rather than just seeing like these very, you know, written word snippets, you get to see the body language, you get to hear people's voices, you get to see them express themselves and the intonations. I just think it's such an awesome thing. And also another thing too that pops into my head is, as you're talking about like text and the focus and everything, it's almost like an anti-gatekeeping sort of aspect to it. You know, because so often in history, if you look at academia or now to business with the different jargon and terms and stuff like that, you know, such a fundamental thing is gatekeeping, like making sure that only certain people can actually access this knowledge.
Following up on what Chris said about gatekeeping, I wanted to ask a question, and perhaps this is going to sound a little bit direct, but what does this all have to do with extractivism?
Great question, Sophia, and hard one. So I would say, following on from Chris's point about gatekeeping, my experience of the past few years teaching global public health was a kind of informal fieldwork into how people relate to knowledge, right? So, and how do you know the whole thing that they call epistemology or whatever? And it's almost like teaching was simply a process of unlearning and unpacking a lot of the kind of authority expectations that were built into a previous formal, what I would differentiate as schooling, that people had, whereby the idea is you need to kind of build an authority over something, and you can kind of take this deep and textualized information from someone as separate and communicate it, and then assimilate it, digest it, and then say something authoritative over them. Weirdly, I don't want to go into this on a tangent too much, but this is based on a particular idea of what a relationship is as a transactional exchange that is comes from the computing world combined with the economics world, which is counteractive to the idea of reciprocity and the relational perspective that anthropologists hold. But anyway, that's a side point. So to me, this is about extractivism, because it's not about that kind of evil billionaires going and nicking people's resources all the time. Sometimes it's just a person who wants to make a point about a topic that they've worked in for a while, maybe as a healthcare professional, and now they're doing a bit of academia and they want to make a point because they felt it, but they don't see, and includes me at certain points, that I don't see that experience itself was part of the knowledge production and process itself. And so instead I go kind of step sideways and then create this formalized process whereby I just go and like interview people and go, okay, that's data. And now I've extracted that. And now I can go back to my institution and to whoever and make a point, which is then going to advance me and my ego and my career and contribute to a paper that enters a stratosphere of like, maybe this will influence some policy. Like, well, do you have like a rich uncle that works in politics? No. So good luck with that. Like, I'm not saying that's not an important realm to think about, policy, policing. It's not a realm I'm interested in. But I would say most people come into academia, the contexts that they already have connections with or will do through, let's say, some field work, identifying, you know, what is the power situation there, who is already self-organizing, maybe you're already self-organizing, or you can support whatever union that is, whatever organization that is, whatever people that are already doing something. And if they're not, maybe having a chat with individuals who are up for that, supporting that and listening, where would my academic kind of strengths and powers come in? That's to me a non-extractivist approach. Yes, you can still go and get your medals and tick your boxes to ensure that you have your own subsistence in order to maintain that relationship. That is not extractivism, in my opinion. That just means that I'm maintaining my ability to participate in that context, right? Subsistence. And so on the last point from that, that's the kind of stuff that I was doing off the back in Bristol before I left. And I still support some of those groups, like the Pan-African Workers Association, Save, St. Paul's Dentist, you know, bigger and smaller things. And I think also a key part of being a non-extractivist academic is not only not to take things away, but just as you took the time to slowly open the relationship, you should also take responsibility to close that relationship if you're not going to go back. Now, when I did my PhD, I attempted these things and I didn't do them as well as I do now. So it's just a much learning curve and I've made many mistakes myself. But that's the ethic of non-extractivist approach that I wanted to mention today.
Absolutely. And thank you. It's really heartening for me to hear this, and I'm sure it is for our listeners too. I mean, it is such an important thing to be able to actually engage and share the outcomes with the people that you're working with. And I think that point too that you bring up of the like responsibly closing relationships, I mean, that's such a huge thing that's often, you know, I don't think brought up enough. And you know, we're all learning. It's a lifelong thing. So it's just getting better and better, hopefully. And I mean, also it's just shocking to me how prevalent this sort of academic extractivism still is in the modern day, these like colonial throwbacks. But we could get into a whole episode about that, I'm sure. But we've taken up a bunch of your time today, as much as this conversation has been amazing, and I'm sure we could keep going for hours. And we definitely would love to have you back in the future to hear about how the project is going. But we're coming towards the end of our time, and at the end of every episode, there's something we like to do.
What are we going to do?
You know what we're going to do.
Do I know what we're going to do? I don't know. Maybe I've forgotten. Can you remind me?
It's question time.
Question time.
So at the end of every episode, we like to ask our guests the question. Our listeners are hearing this conversation. They're fascinated. They want to be able to do something. Is there anything you can recommend for them? Something they could read, something they could think about, something they could do in their lives, some organizations they could check out, anything that our listeners could do to find out more and be more engaged?
Okay, tough question, but I've got three answers to that. First one is, if you are working at Helsinki University, please keep your ear out for the forthcoming Reset Network. Reset Network focuses on resilient and just answers to the challenges that humankind are facing today, broadly speaking, with a large focus on climate change, but also other issues. And this is a collaboration between lots of research centers. And I am one of the first postdocs as part of this research. I think it's an environment rather than network. So if you're already aware of it, then I would urge you, as your challenge is, to get in contact with me so that we can have a chat and see where we can go with this. Beyond that, what I would ask of people is this. So if you don't want to fight a pest, let's just say it's a mosquito for the purposes of today. It could be some other pest in your life. And you don't want to necessarily always think of it at a personal level, more at an ecological scale. And you're not going to believe the story that the prime directive is war between different genetic codes and the envelopes that hold them, then the first thing is to avoid the inverse opposite, which is where we usually go, right? So when I say, I don't want to have a war with the mosquitoes, and people go, well, then we should make friends with them, you know, make kin with other more than human. Now, the problem with that is premised on there being a war already. I'm trying to say that there's no war at all. It's a delusion. So my challenge, people, is go away and do some role play. Maybe make some art. Maybe just write down one sentence. I don't know the answer to this. So I basically, can you do my research project for me? If we get rid of that prime directive of war as defining our relationship to pests, and also the easy kind of inverse of let's not have a war, but that's premised on the idea of having had a war. What is there once there's this kind of, you know, there's pests bumbling about, there's us bumbling about. We're not always playing, we're not playing. Sometimes we're having some little fight. What's a different way to theatrically imagine a relationship with pests? So I would really like any thoughts, any experiments on that. And ultimately, in about 2 years, whoever has contacted me, we're going to build a huge mosquito on campus, and then we're going to do a reenactment where we're going to fight the mosquito and have a little war. And then we're going to do a second part to that play, which will be whatever good answers people have come up with. So that's the long-term plan, and that's the challenge. So please, people, help me. Oh, and you can also go and read the Animal Cross Location blog that I've started if you want to. I think it's helpful because it's quite vulnerable. It's very half-baked thoughts. So you can see how the project is progressing, and you can have lots of areas for possible ways to undermine what I'm saying because it's very half-baked. So please do check that out and come back to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you for such a wonderful answer to the question. And we will make sure to put links to the things mentioned in the show notes for our listeners who are interested to find out more.
Yes, thank you so much, Avi. It's been such a pleasure to have you on here to get into your work and so many of these different topics. As I mentioned before, we would absolutely love to have you back on in the future to see how things are coming along, to get more into these areas that we didn't totally get into, and of course, to find out how the, I guess you could say, mosquito war reenactment plan is coming along. I would certainly love to participate in that. But yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Chris and Sophia. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you once again to Avi Betz-Heinemann for coming on and sharing his insights and experience with so many different quote-unquote pests around the world and his exciting plans for his work in the Reset Project. Please join us next month when we're going to be speaking with Joe Spence, Nick Chamberlain, and welcoming back Avi to speak about documentary filmmaking and the social sciences and their film From the Cubby about lived experiences of sleeping rough and a tuberculosis outbreak in southeastern England. From the suddenly cold autumn of Helsinki, Finland, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sophia Hagelani-Albov, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.